Welcome to Mormon Land, a podcast about all things Mormon produced by the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, editor of the Tribune, and I'm here with senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. Peggy, hello.
Hello.
Nearly a year ago to the day, two Salt Lake City attorneys launched the Refugee Justice League to protect the legal rights of refugees to this country. And James McConkie, an attorney at Utah-based Parker & McConkie and a practicing Mormon, was one of them. He's here in the studio to talk about the nonpartisan nonprofit project. And Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thank you so much. What prompted you to organize this group?
It'll surprise you. It was the Salt Lake Tribune.
The Tribune! Wonderful!
Let me tell you how this came about. You did an article about refugees, and I know you probably know this person, but it's Noor, who is an activist.
Oh, Noor, yeah.
And I read an article where you quoted her, and she said, I thought that this community, and then she also said the Mormons, had our backs. And I read that, and this was just after the general election in November, and I got this sick feeling, and I said to myself, this state should not be characterized as not having the backs of refugees, because I was aware that there was a lot of goodwill out there in all of the communities, the Mormon community, the Catholic community, even the non-religious communities have been very welcoming to refugees. So I walked into my office and I said to Brad, have you seen this article? He said no, and I read it to him.
He's talking about Noor El-Hassan, who's a Muslim activist in Utah.
Yeah, thank you. And so he said to me, well, we're lawyers, aren't we? We should be able to do something. And that's how we started talking about putting together a group of attorneys to represent refugees free of cost, pro bono.
So this is called the Mormon Land Podcast.
Oh, uh-huh.
So how does your faith inform this action?
Well, I didn't expect that question because I usually talk in a more secular way. It's funny that I'd feel out of my comfort zone. but I felt deeply that the Latter-day Saints shouldn't be characterized this way because it was a denial of their own history, and it would give the impression that we didn't appreciate what had happened to us and that we hadn't learned the lesson of inclusiveness and being non-judgmental. And so to think that my tribe might be characterized that way, I wanted to make sure that there was a force going in the other direction. That was the personal side of that for me.
It's been well received, and not just a Mormon thing. I mean,
Right. Attorneys
from all sorts of backgrounds have joined this bandwagon, right?
Right. That was my personal motive. But we've been very careful to make this a non-denominational kind of thing, a non-political type of thing. Democrats, Republicans, you know, people of any political persuasion. And we have a broad array of attorneys from small firms, big firms, of all types of backgrounds and interests.
How many do you have, do you think?
Well, we have over 300, probably close to 350. The way it started is that we called some of our friends and said, let's have a press conference. And we got the press interested, and they came. And we had maybe 20. And then a week later, it was up to 50. A couple of weeks later, 100. And now it's up to close to 350. And these attorneys are involved, and they're doing things, and they're helping people. And it's been a great success.
What was your first case?
Oh, well, the first case involved a child in an elementary school, a Muslim, who had been wearing a hijab. And
that's a headscarf.
A headscarf. And the kids had bullied her and were pulling it off. And so we got involved. And, you know, usually just a letter from an attorney on official stationery gets everybody's minds focused. And you can settle these things on a without having to go to the courtroom or become litigious, as reasonable people should.
It was that here along the Wasatch Front?
Yeah, it was here along the Wasatch Front, in the Granite School District.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did that stop? Did that?
Oh yeah,
what
it
happened?
Stopped, and some wonderful things have come about as a result of it. We've had a number of those cases, and because it seemed like a repeated type of a problem, Mikkel Withers, who sits on our advisory committee, he was the Salt Lake City Superintendent of Schools here. He's not a lawyer, but you don't have to be a member of this group, and he has worked out and is working on religious clothing language that we hope in the next little while will become a standard policy for all of Utah. And so we're working on that, and he's perfectly suited to work on that type of an issue. So we hope that comes about.
So these are all done pro bono?
All pro bono.
Correct. Were you, was your league involved with that imam that got stuck in Kenya?
That was a very high profile.
Yeah, tell us about that a little bit.
Well, we got a call from a friend of the imam, and they said, Imam Abdi of the Madeira Mosque is stuck in Kenya, and he went over there to get his family and his five children, and the youngest was 4 months old. And he went over there because he hadn't been able to get his wife into the country, and he'd spent all of this time finally getting the paperwork together. I mean, this is 5 years later. And he's now a citizen because he came over 5 years earlier. It takes 5 years to become a citizen. So he went over, and he went to the airport, and he was told by the airlines, Qatar Airlines, that he could not board because the United States had forbidden it. And so we got this call, and Brad and I must have 100 pages of texts going back and forth, and we started working on this case. And so we called the embassy, he went to the embassy, came to the airport the next day, we called our congressional offices, we started working on a lawsuit, which we eventually filed. And he went to the airport, and he was able to get on board. He flew to Qatar. He was then delayed in Qatar. He then flew to Los Angeles. Well, by this time, we'd gone to the federal court and asked for a temporary restraining order, asking an order be entered that if he did not board, that the judge would prevent the United States from carrying out the order, and that they would force the United States to allow the imam on the plane. So he got to Los Angeles, and he goes through customs. Delay, delay, delay. Misses his 6 o'clock flight. So we say, well, that's easy. We're still on target here. Get on the 8 o'clock flight. And so they have to search him again, and they take so long that he misses the 8 o'clock flight. So he called, and I said, well, go find a hotel. But my legal advice is get up early, get to the airport at 7 so you can catch that 11 o'clock flight. So he got up early, they went through, they spent all of this time, in an inordinate amount of time, searching him. He got to the gate, and about 20 minutes before the plane is about to take off, 7 TASA agents come to the gate.
What's TASA?
TASA is the group that checks you for security going in and out of the airport.
TSA.
TSA,
that's what I call it.
Yeah.
Well, okay, yeah, got it.
I should say TSA, actually. That's a good catch on your part. But anyway, TSA came up, 7 of them. TASA, by the way, is a group that of attorneys that find expert witnesses. That's what was in my mind. But that advertisement aside, TSA came up, 7 of them, for each member of the family, essentially. And they said, Abdi, you can get on the plane, but your wife can't. And you can take your 4 kids, but we've got to search your wife now. We're concerned about her. So Abdi at this point was just shaken, and he begins appealing to the audience and explaining what's happening. And the pilot is standing there listening to this, and he calls the police. And the police come to the gate, and there's a stand down. And finally, this American Airlines pilot says, and now they're 10 minutes past the time they should have taken off. The pilot says, I just want you to know I'm not flying this plane until Abdi and his family are on it. And at that point, TSA stood down. They got on the plane, and the imam flies into Salt Lake City with his family to the cheers of well-wishers and to the cheers of his congregation. And he gives this touching speech, just sui sponte, just from his heart. And he, you'd think he would have said, this is a horrible country. I couldn't get home. And his message to his congregation is, and he repeats it three times, we need to be peaceful. We need to be peaceful. We need to be peaceful. This is a great country. God bless America. We have freedom of religion here, and we also have friends. And when I heard that, we also have friends, and the League was involved, it felt like, yes, we have done the right thing. The refugees have friends.
That almost sounds like a commercial for American Airlines, which could use some good press right now, you know?
Well, they certainly could, but you know, the funny thing is that we wanted to find out who the pilot was.
Yeah, absolutely.
And American Airlines would not tell us.
Really?
I kind of wondered, you know, do they want to keep this low key?
Interesting.
They didn't want to tell us. We tried.
Any other memorable case? I mean, that was the most public case, but any other cases? I mean, I really like hearing about the bullying outcome.
Yeah.
Anything else that you could chalk up to a success?
Yeah, there was one, and it's not, we don't really take credit for it because the police got involved, but there was a situation in Salt Lake City where the Islamic members were trying to pray, and someone was coming through the parking lot, speeding with his pickup truck, trying to dissuade them and scare them from going in the building. Of course, the police picked up on that. But those are the kinds of things that you see, harassment between neighbors. But, you know, you ask me, Peggy, one of the ones that is really satisfying, and that's the Bhutanese Temple Project. And in this community, we have about 2,000 people in the Bhutanese community. And they were in Bhutan. They've been persecuted by the Buddhists. They're Hindus. And the Buddhists actually in Bhutan passed a law that essentially disenfranchised these people. And so they were pushed into a neighboring country. And then they've come to the United States. About 100,000 have been in this fix. It's been a very serious thing. But we have about 2,000 that have come over in the last few years as refugees. And Holland and Hart, under Craig Galley and Matt Worthland's efforts in that firm, have agreed to do all of the legal work for them free. That's thousands and thousands of dollars, so that they can become a nonprofit, purchase land, and establish a temple. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if we could put it right next to the Salt Lake Temple?
How'd that go?
It would be a wonderful thing to have that kind of diversity in downtown Salt Lake. So I hope whatever happens that it becomes a visible symbol of inclusion in our community.
I have a story in the Salt Lake Tribune that it addresses the League's efforts on behalf of the Bhutanese and Nepalese temple that is trying to find land and be built here in Utah.
Awesome. Check it out, sltrib.com. Well, speaking of the church, LDS Church launched this I Was a Stranger refugee program, and I'm just wondering if that had any influence or inspiration on your efforts.
Well, I knew that when we started this, that the church was on board, and it had, because I actually had been assigned a refugee as part of my duties as a Latter-day Saint in my local congregation, and I was working on with that family, and I was pleased by particularly the way the Relief Society got so deeply involved, and so yes, I knew the church was going to be supportive, and they have been. I mean, I think they're.
In what way have they been?
Well,
supportive?
They've been. You know, just the fact that they're on the record makes it so much easier to get things done. And people see it as legitimate. They see it as something that they should be doing as a church community. And they volunteer, and they really get involved. We just had a night for refugees in our local ward where we were putting Christmas kinds of items together for them. And I'll be delivering those with some of the other members of the ward later on this week or early next week. So there's a lot of energy in this community for helping refugees, probably more volunteers than you can use in some instances.
So in the church's eyes, refugees are not scary, but I think other faiths are also are a little more wary of refugees, and
especially given President Trump's ban on certain countries.
Right, right.
Well, the thing that I find so remarkable is how the evangelical movement seems so distant from this problem in terms of trying to be inclusive and helpful, or so supportive of policies that herd refugees and isolate them and keep them from integrating into our communities. You know, there's a spillover effect on immigration policy and refugee policy, because people think that they mistake refugees with immigrants. They don't realize that refugees have legal papers, but they're kind of lumped in. And so all of this, let's stop these horrible people from coming into our country who don't have passports and are coming in illegally, have a spillover effect on refugees to a significant extent. And then, of course, the spillover effect of that type of a policy is that it fractionalizes our society and causes us from being more inclusive, which I think those two things are real negatives.
Well, yes, the church has spoken out in favor of serving refugees. Is there more that they could do, though, at least in the policy arena?
Well, I guess that's a good question. I would like to see them put pressure on political leaders to a greater extent, if I had my way. Yes, I'd like to see them be more active, but I can't fault them for having not been active. They're appearing at the UN. They're talking about it. They're doing a tremendous amount in Europe that we're not entirely aware of. My son was serving over there, and Elder Uchtdorf came to Czechoslovakia, and one of the first things he wanted to highlight was the refugee problem, and he went to one of the camps over there. Of course, Elder Uchtdorf, his family was a refugee family, and he, in fact, tracked his pilgrimage, as it were, as a refugee out of Czechoslovakia back into Germany while he was there. He went to the place where his family lived, and, you know, he should really talk about that, but he was very active in that area while he was in Europe, and the saints are. I mean, this isn't something that's just that we're doing in the United States or just in the West.
Do you see any spillover from your efforts for refugees with immigrants?
There is, yeah. We've had to be careful because if we got into the immigration area, we'd be absolutely swamped and we'd come to a standstill. But what we're doing has a spillover effect. I'll give you one example. If a person shoplifts, and they're charged with a misdemeanor that has a penalty of 365 days, and they're a refugee or an immigrant, it's automatic deportation. So you have a situation where an 18-year-old does it, and they send him back to the country that might kill him because he's a refugee, because his life was in danger in that country. So if we have a legislative committee that's meeting, and we're talking about asking the legislature to lower the penalty by one day, to make it a 364-day penalty. Now, if you do that, it doesn't trigger the federal sanctions. And this has been done successfully in California and some other states. And so by working on the refugee problem over here, that would, in fact, have a spillover effect on the immigration area as well.
You're talking about entering a policymaking arena.
Well, yes.
Which, yeah. I mean, was that part of your original mission, or is that experience from a year, and we're seeing
experience
that
from
there's
a, year,
a problem.
And there's a problem, and we want to address it, and we can. John T. Nielsen, who I'm sure many people know, he's the chairman of the Liquor Commission, but he also was the governmental agency guy for IHC, has a lot of experience on the Hill. He's the chairperson, and we've got good, solid people with expertise on that committee, and it's exciting. I mean, we'd even like to get money from Medicaid for various types of problems that are unique to refugees. Refugees need mental health, have mental health issues, and so they need money when they've been tortured and they have PTSD and all of these issues. We need to find ways to get money to help them with their mental health issues. And as you know, that's sometimes tricky and not very popular.
Did you did you handle a lot of those cards to refugees?
The cards.
Say if you need help, call these lawyers,
right,
or something like
we're,
that.
We're going a little more slowly on that, and the reason is that it's been controversial with the police, and so we have been meeting with the police and talking to them about their concerns. But yes,
what are they?
Well, it makes their job harder.
Yes,
I'm an old prosecutor and I've been a defense attorney. I understand what their problems are, and so I can see why they would be sensitive. Feel this is a sensitive issue, but the relationship between the police and the refugee is an important issue, and the reason it is that refugees are afraid of the police. They've been killed by the military and the police of their own country. They've done studies on this. And so no matter how much the police want to engage and become their friend, there's a tremendous barrier. And there's an intentional lack of communication between refugees and the police. So if the police want information from them to help solve the crime, the refugee's automatic response is to say, I don't speak the language, I don't know what you're talking about. And so what we have been trying to do is if a refugee is contacted by a police officer, we have a card, and we're passing these out, but going slowly, and it says, I'm represented by the Refugee Justice League. At that moment, the police can't talk to them. And then we invite the police and the refugee to come to our office, and we find out what the police want to know, and then we try and give the refugee assurance that they can, in a safe way, cooperate and give information to the police and kind of facilitate by our example, show how, in our country, you can work with the police. On the other hand, if there's a reason they shouldn't be talking to the police, then like all of us, they ought to assert their constitutional rights. And so this actually has been one of the more controversial things that we've been involved in.
That's interesting, because you have trust issues with the police, but also with the refugees, because they're native countries.
Right.
They may have been brutalized by law enforcement. Yeah. I mean, that's tricky territory.
Well, it's very tricky territory. The Police Executive Research Forum has done a study. And over 50% of refugees have been physically harmed in their own countries by the police or the military. And when you ask a refugee the question of how do you feel about the police, these are the terms that come up. Fear, rapist, power, corruption, intimidation, no trust, they will beat you, they will take your life, run from them.
Wow.
So we had a situation where a new refugee, was just walking down the street and saw a police officer, and the automatic response was run. As soon as he started running, what did the police do? Run after him and tackle him. And so this is why there is a need for lawyers to kind of get in the mix and try and build permanent bridges between the police and the refugee community. Now, I have to tell you, in fairness, that the Salt Lake City Police Department has been trying to build bridges, but we don't think they can really bridge the entire gap without some help.
Mm-hmm. So where do you see your organization in a year or in 5 years?
You know, that's such an interesting question. We've been actually talking about that because we're almost hitting our anniversary, and we've hired somebody half-time, so that it's now becoming an organization that can kind of function on its own. We've involved a lot of people on committees. We have an executive committee. We're putting together an advisory board. So we're beginning to see something that was kind of a spur of the moment thing in, based on an article in the Tribune kind of come into fuller fruition.
I'm going to have to put you on my marketing team. This is awesome.
And establish itself. But I think in a year we should really be going great guns, yeah.
I'll just put you in your discomfort zone again, just about the personal faith. So yeah. This has been about a year into this project, and has it affected your belief system in any way? Or your belief in the church, or
Well, it's heightened to a significant degree my appreciation for the programs of the church that reach out to the poor, the hungry, the disadvantaged. And when I see these Latter-day Saints with their yellow shirts, and when I see my ward respond, and when people when you say to someone, we have a refugee family and they need help, and the response is, what can I do? Having been up close and personal with some of these people, I have a greater appreciation for the amount of money, the amount of effort, the amount of goods and services that the church invests in the disadvantaged and those who've been kind of removed for various reasons from the mainstream of society. And it's really been heartwarming. It strengthened my conviction, and not a testimony. I'm not talking about testimony here. I'm talking about my conviction of the goodness of Jesus Christ and the church embracing the model which he exemplified in the four Gospels.
Do you think it would have been a harder sell if the church had not spoken out? Or would the LDS historical experience with being kicked out and being essentially refugees themselves, would that have spoken for itself?
Yeah, no, I think had the church not become publicly involved and made a statement and had the Relief Society talk about it in conference, that it would have been much more difficult, because I'm a Democrat. I've run as a Democrat, and we're in a minority, and Trump had just won the election, and there are lots of Republican Mormons, and it wasn't going to work very well, because most people in this state voted for Trump, and that's what prompted this response from the Islamic community. And so there was a sense out there that this, I guess, is okay, because it's part of our, kind of fits into our political ideology. And for the church to come out and say, no, it isn't okay, and we need to reach out, and we don't want to marginalize this group, has been, I think, essential. I think it's changed. You know, when I go around and talk to people from other states, they call and want to know what's going on. And we have a reputation all over the country for being one of the most welcoming states and I to refugees. I just don't think that would have been the case had it not been for the church's public stand on this issue.
Jim McConkie, he is with the Refugee Justice League, sort of a legal superhero for the refugee community. Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, we've had a lot of fun with that Refugee Justice League title.
Thank you so much. Thanks, for coming in.
Well, it's nice to be here and nice to meet you as well.
More coverage of the Refugee Justice League at refugeejustice.org. Lots of news coverage on this organization and refugee news, as well as Mormonland at sltrib.com. Thanks so much for listening to Mormonland today. For Peggy Fletcher Stack, I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Hope you'll tune in again next time.